Scott Bailey, your new book is terrific, and I'm curious about the title. It's called Romeo, Juliet, and Other Screwed Up Teenagers, an irreverent yet thorough guide to introducing the world's most staggeringly inappropriate play to a classroom full of confused freshmen. And so I'm wondering to what degree the screwed up teenagers refers as much to your students as it does to the characters in the play.
Well, just to be on the safe side, I guess I'll focus just on Romeo and Juliet themselves.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 18th year, number 909, Screwed Up Teenagers. Scott Bailey's new book, Romeo, Juliet, and Other Screwed Up Teenagers, an irreverent guide to introducing the world's most staggeringly inappropriate play to a classroom full of confused freshmen, is a funny and frank look at Shakespeare's arguably most popular play, which he's been teaching for almost 30 years. I really liked Scott's book, and so I was thrilled to chat with him and try to explain why I thought his book was so readable and valuable. Your book reminds me both of Ken Ludwig's book, How to Teach Your Children Shakespeare, and Michelle Ephraim's book that I just did a podcast with her about, Green World, which is a memoir of her coming to Shakespeare in a weird way, taking a while to get there, figuring out how to teach him. And it's not, all of this is a long way of saying it's a not dissimilar to, I feel like, the work that we do with the Reduced Shakespeare Company, which is to approach Shakespeare irreverently and not the way that we were taught, which was too reverently. Is any of that fair or make any sense?
No, absolutely. And, you know, I have to just remind myself and remind the students every so often that this play, none of his plays were written so that students would have to be in a classroom reading it and writing essays and taking multiple choice tests. And unfortunately, that's part of my job to do all that. But I have to constantly remind the students, he wrote these plays to put butts in the seats. And, you know, I took my students on a field trip 10 years ago we went to the Globe in London, and then we went to the Edinburgh Festival Fringe to put on a show. And I was just reminded by the tour guide at the Globe is, you know, about how close the bear baiting theaters. In fact, I assume some of the theaters were used for both bear baiting and for putting on plays.
Right.
And the plays that Shakespeare put on, they had to be entertaining enough to make people say, well, we could watch a bear being mutilated by a bunch of dogs, or we could go watch a play. So how are we going to spend our evening and our tuppence? And so the plays had to be that good. They had to be better than watching a bear being torn apart by dogs, and if he was going to make any money at all. And so that's what I have to keep reminding the students, that these plays were meant to be fun. That's the main thing. And yeah, we got to do the school stuff as well. But I try my best to, you know, focus on the fact that this is funny. This is action-packed. This is messed up.
Well, and I think that's right, too. Teaching it as a theatrical script rather than a piece of literature. It has literary value, absolutely, no question, but I'm not sure that in ninth grade, or even in many grades, that the literary value is the most appealing, at least not for me. I'm thrilled to hear that you take your students to see Shakespeare where it should be seen, in a theater.
Yeah, I haven't unfortunately been able to do that so much lately, but there's been plenty of times. I remember once in my drama class, I taught the students Measure for Measure, which is sort of unusual to teach in high school. But I knew that there was this theater company in LA called The Noise Within. They'd always done some great stuff. And so they were putting on Measure for Measure. So I thought, let's read that and let's go on a field trip and see it. And it was like a student kind of field trip day, and there was a lot of students on one side of the theater, and then my students, we were off sitting on the house right side. And I just remember my students, after they had already read the play and we talked about it, they could enjoy it so much more than I could. Just see the students who were not my students and probably had no idea what the play was. I could just see them off on the other side, just talking. I mean, this was before texting. They weren't texting at the time. I'm sure they would be now, but you know, you could see that it was hard for them to focus on it. And that's unfortunately one of the difficult things about teaching high school Shakespeare, is that you want the students to see the play first.
Yeah.
And with something like Romeo and Juliet, you can actually show them a movie, especially if it's like the Baz Luhrmann movie, mm-hmm. or maybe the Zeffirelli movie, even though you might have to skip over certain scenes, obviously. And at least the students can get the basic gist of what's going on. They probably won't understand every gallop of pace, you fiery footed steeds part, but you know, they'll understand the basic story. Measure for Measure might be a little bit more complicated, or you know, God forbid, Cymbeline or something of that nature. So it's great to introduce the play first, but then go back and read it, and ideally have them see another production. I mean, I think that's sort of the key with Shakespeare, is you have to read it, see it, go back and read it, see another production, go back and read it again, and just do that until you pass away.
Well, and you must be constantly discovering new things about the script.
Absolutely. Yeah. Every time I teach it, it's really no exaggeration. And I mean, I just taught Macbeth a couple, you know, just wrapped it up. The kids are writing their essays. But even with Macbeth, which I've also taught innumerable times, it surprises me that not just every year, but like with every class, I'll teach it like three times, you know, three different classes, and practically every class I'll pick up something that never occurred to me before. And so it's, you know, the gift that keeps on giving at Shakespeare.
Yeah, it really is. Can you tell me your origin story when it comes to Shakespeare? How did you discover him and develop your love for him?
Yeah, I bring this up in the book pretty early on, is that I was probably like a lot of students. I, you know, we had to learn it in high school. We did Romeo and Juliet in high school. We watched the Zeffirelli movie, I believe unedited, because I guess teachers didn't know better at the time. And of course, you know, certain scenes we all remember, especially because it was 1980 and there wasn't There weren't boobs on TV back in 1980, or at least they were very, very difficult to find. Yeah. Whereas right there in class, all of a sudden, yikes, there they are. So obviously that was one of the main memories, and, you know, the basic story. But overall, you know, it did seem like a foreign language, and we didn't really do anything where we had to act it out. And then Julius Caesar, my sophomore year, which was, you know, almost even more impenetrable. Senior year, Macbeth, which went a little bit better in high school. I mean, and the main thing was our teacher made us memorize the Tomorrow, Tomorrow, Tomorrow speech, which I still have in my brain. And I even went on a game show a couple years after I graduated, and they asked me, it was The Joker's Wild in the pre Snoop Dogg days. I guess he was hosting it, but in the Bill Cullen days, and Bill Cullen said, complete this line from William Shakespeare's Macbeth. It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying what? And I said nothing, and I won, and I thanked Mr. Andrews, my English teacher. But even at that point, it was still, you know, the real love wasn't there. It wasn't until I got to UCLA, which I didn't go to right away after high school. I had a sort of interesting journey to finally make it to UCLA. And then I had to take a Shakespeare class, which I actually did not do very well in, but it was the first time I started seeing students do Shakespeare. And then strangely enough, watching some of the BBC versions, especially the Othello with Anthony Hopkins, who I think is probably the last white guy to play Othello, except for the one with Patrick Stewart, where where he played Othello and everyone else in the play was black. But Anthony Hopkins played Othello, you know, with not with the Laurence Olivier, you know, blackface, but, you know, with tan. Right. And that version sort of, it was one of the first times it really started catching on. And it was especially because of Bob Hoskins' performance, because he didn't seem Shakespearean. He seemed like this Cockney, troublemaking, really fascinating guy who was just taking so much delight in torturing Othello. And I think just seeing that in the Powell Library at UCLA with these horrible earphones on a screen that big.
Yeah.
That, I think that was one of the first real, you know, times when I really started getting it. And then I saw a production of Midsummer Night's Dream at what is now the Geffen Theater. And it was all done in like Dr. Seuss kind of clothing. And of course seeing, and I should mention, we were talking earlier, but I my freshman year of high school, or between freshman and sophomore year, I worked at the Renaissance Fair, which was right in our neighborhood in Agoura. And I would see the original, pre-Renew Shakespeare Company, but Adam Long and Jess Winfield, Romeo and Juliet, you know, but that didn't seem like Shakespeare at the time. It just seemed like a really fun, good time, but it didn't have the onus of, this is serious, this is Shakespeare.
I love that your origin story includes the nascent reduced Shakespeare Company.
Yeah. I don't think I did any Shakespeare in college, but then finally I did some production of Twelfth Night where I played the sea captain and first officer. And that was sort of the start of it. And so since then I've acted in, I would assume 14, 15 of the shows of his plays, different joints. Most recently at the Independent Shakespeare Company, which is this, now it's this huge phenomenon out here in LA. They put on free Shakespeare in Griffith Park. And so I did a few of their history plays when they needed a lot of people. and now they have their casts now are these young, sexy people for the most part. So they got rid of all of us graybeards. But but at the time they needed a bunch of us. So I did Richard II and Henry IV and Henry V.
I mean, but that's very cool. You paid your dues both in the classroom and on the stage.
Hi, I'm Ken Ludwig, a playwright and author of Lend Me a Tenor, Crazy for You, Baskerville, and the new book, How to Teach Your Children Shakespeare. And you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This fall of 2024, we'll be performing the special election edition of The Complete History of America Abridged in Illinois, Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Colorado. We'll have specific venues and dates up on our website very soon. Now back to my conversation with Scott Bailey, who was telling me about the impulse to write his new book, Romeo, Juliet, and Other Screwed-Up Teenagers, an irreverent guide to introducing the world's most staggeringly inappropriate play to a classroom full of confused freshmen.
It was one of those things where I always said, you know, I haven't teaching this so long, I could write a book about all the stuff that I've thought about regarding this play. And then a situation occurred where I taught at this one school that I really didn't like. And then my mother passed away and I inherited enough money that I had no plans to stop working. But my wife actually said, you know, you need a break. And why don't you just take a year off and she didn't say and write a book. She just said, I think you just probably, because I've been teaching for, you know, 27 years or something like that. Why don't you just take a year and relax? Because I had such a terrible time at the previous school and it was COVID and everyone was masked the whole time and just teaching, you know, I'm not an anti-masker or anti-vaxxer or anything like that, but it was just, you know, soul crushing to teach with a mask on to a bunch of students who had masks on. Where you couldn't see them smile, you know, a whole year without, you know, seeing students smile and not even knowing if they were, you know, enjoying what I was doing or what. And so I needed a break, and but I couldn't just, you know, sit on my butt for a year. And so I thought, well, might as well do this and see what happens. And so I just, just started typing it. And it was a pretty easy book to write. You know, I hear of people with, all sorts of writer's block and whatnot. But being that the book just sort of, I mean, the second half of the book or most of the book covers just the play scene by scene. So it wasn't like I ever woke up going, oh no, what am I going to write about today? Well, I just finished writing about Act 2, Scene 1. So today I'm writing about Act 2, Scene 2.
Well, and that's the other glory of the book, really, is that it's an incredible tool for actors embarking on a production of Romeo and Juliet because of the deep dive that you do with every scene in the play. Like, I just had a professional actor friend auditioning to play Lord Capulet in some production somewhere. And he was asking me questions. And I said, you know what? I am reading Scott Bailey's book right now. And I took a picture of the pages that deal with Lord Capulet. There's like three of them. And he went, oh my God, this is incredibly helpful. Wow. So, I mean, I do think it's an incredible resource for not only, teachers who will read it and go, oh my God, yes, I'm going through the same thing, but actors going, oh my God, this makes a ton of sense, and I've never thought of it this way before.
Yeah, what I try to bring to the book, something that, as much as I love Harold Bloom, James Shapiro, Marjorie Garber, all those people, being that I've directed the play, I've acted in it, I've taught it a million times, that there's certain aspects that I'm interested in, just the nuts and bolts of how to put this play on. And for instance, there's a big passage in it that's specifically about how to get a dead body off the stage when it's in the middle of the play. Right. And of course, today that's not an issue, because if you put on a Shakespeare play in a theater today, if there's a dead body on stage in Act 3, then you turn off the lights, or maybe even close the curtain, and just have the person walk off stage. But in Shakespeare's day, curtains existed, but they didn't have curtains come up and down after every scene. And I believe they didn't really have anything in the way of intermission, and they couldn't turn the lights down. So it's fascinating how, if a character does die in the middle of a play, like Julius Caesar, like Mercutio, that they had to deal with it, because it's really hard to pick a body up. And the first time I directed a kid to do that, just say, oh yeah, just pick him up and take him off stage. And it was a pretty strong kid, and the dead kid wasn't even that big, but it was really hard, you know, for him to pick it up. And I thought, oh, okay. And it's funny how Shakespeare knew that at the time. And so he would write these characters. And I make a big point in the book, even though it's supposed to be about Romeo and Juliet, but I go into all sorts of other things. But, you know, there's a character in Julius Caesar of Octavius Caesar's servant who doesn't seem to have any function at all, except he has to come in and help Mark Antony pick up Julius Caesar's body and take it off the stage. Because even though most people who play Mark Antony tend to be, you know, pretty buff, it's still the idea of him in the middle of the play trying to pick up whatever, probably fat guy playing Julius Caesar, and not look ridiculous. But if you have two people come out, you can do it a lot easier. And so I like, you know, I just noticed things like why, you know, Mercutio doesn't even get to die on stage in the play. You know, Benvolio drags him off. You know, Mercutio has to say, fetch me, you know, go find me a surgeon or take me to a house. And Benvolio drags him off, and then Benvolio comes back a couple seconds later and says, oh, brave Mercutio's dead. And, you know, wouldn't it be better to have seen Mercutio die on stage? And in most movies, that's what they do. They don't have him die off stage. But in Shakespeare's day, without the lights, then, yeah, you couldn't just have Mercutio's dead body. But then you also have Tybalt's dead body, and who dies a little bit after. And there are lines that the prince has to say. He has to tell people, come, bear this body hence. And but at the end of the play, when it's a total bloodbath and, you know, a whole bunch of people are dead, they don't have to do that. They just let them sit there and die and stay dead until curtain call.
Do you think you'll write a follow-up, a similar book about another one of Shakespeare's plays?
I probably could. I'd like to. I really enjoyed writing this one, even though it would be probably difficult if I'm also teaching. I think George Orwell said once, it's really hard to be a teacher and write, because teaching, I think he called it a semi-creative job, but by the time I'm done with the day of teaching, my brain is not really in active mode. I used to write a lot of screenplays a long time ago, but I would have jobs where I would just work in offices and do data entry or be assistants to agents, but there was no creativity involved. So I could come home and I could actually, write for a couple hours, but teaching. But I'd love to. I really enjoyed writing this book. I wrote a lot of it here in my house, but I also love just going to different coffee houses all over the Southern California area, and if they have Wi-Fi, and just setting up my computer and so it was a very enjoyable experience. So I'd love to be able to do it again. This is certainly not the only Shakespeare play that I've taught hundreds of times and have a lot to say about. So it could happen.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. Scott Bailey's new book, Romeo, Juliet, and Other Screwed-Up Teenagers, An Irreverent Guide to Introducing the World's Most Staggeringly Inappropriate Play to a Classroom Full of Confused Freshmen, is available at Amazon. Send us your wisdom, born of 30 years' experience, via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com, or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. Thanks, as always, to comically aging nurse Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Dan Pelletier. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Ken Ludwig, prolific playwright and author of How to Teach Your Children Shakespeare. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 909 2727ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Let's sell some books so we can... I'm dying to read your deep cut exegesis of Macbeth next.
I have a lot to say about that guy.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.